From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Irish writer Shane Connaughton. He co-wrote the screenplay for My Left Foot. His new movie, The Playboys, stars Aidan Quinn and Albert Finney. It's based on Connaughton's memories of growing up in a small village just south of the border with Northern Ireland. Also, designing a new ballpark with traditional values. We talk with Joe Spear, the principal architect of the Baltimore Orioles' new home. Rock critic Ed Ward tells us how not to do a reissue. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the last episode of The Cosby Show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A jury in Simi Valley, California, has found four Los Angeles police officers not guilty of all but one count of using excessive force to subdue Rodney King. Kitty Feldy of station KLON reports from the courthouse.
The jury said it had decided last Friday that officers Lawrence Powell, Timothy Wynn, Ted Brasino, and Sergeant Stacy Kuhn were not guilty of assault with a deadly weapon, and that Brasino and Kuhn had not filed false police reports. But the jury told Judge Stanley Weisberg they were hopelessly deadlocked on whether Powell was guilty of assault under color of authority. Judge Weisberg declared a mistrial on that one count.
The court finds that there's no reasonable probability that a verdict can be reached, and a mistrial is declared as to that count, count two, in regards to Mr. Powell.
The NAACP and other groups expressed concern early on that moving the trial from Los Angeles County to predominantly white conservative Ventura County would favor the defendants. Community leaders have appealed for calm no matter what the verdict. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Simi Valley, California.
President Bush today extended his freeze on a new government regulations, claiming that the moratorium has saved as much as $20 billion for businesses and taxpayers. The president extended the 90-day moratorium by another 4 months, saying that overregulation costs jobs and that many of the regulations in the works are unnecessary or expensive. Critics of the moratorium said that it has stalled improvements in health, safety, and environmental programs. Two watchdog groups, Public Citizen and OMB Watch, said the freeze has delayed, weakened, or killed about 50 regulations designed to protect areas such as worker safety and environmental protection. Fresh from his decisive win in the Pennsylvania Democratic primary, Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton went to Capitol Hill today and picked up even more superdelegates. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
For months, many Democrats in Congress had been holding back their endorsements. These lawmakers serve as uncommitted superdelegates at the convention in July, and they were reluctant to rally behind Clinton as long as voters continued to tell pollsters they were uneasy with his candidacy. But exit polls in Pennsylvania showed that Clinton had succeeded in improving his image. That, plus the fact that Clinton's nomination is virtually assured, helped get the superdelegates on board. 31 Democratic members of Congress signed on today, bringing Clinton's delegate total to 1,520. California's Don Edwards, who had been leading a group of uncommitted delegates, said he was supporting Clinton now, too. Clinton may not need to convince many more superdelegates to endorse him. His campaign aides say if Clinton wins just one-third of the delegates from the remaining primaries, he'll have enough support to win the Democratic nomination on the first ballot. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 25 points today to close at 3,333. This is NPR. There are conflicting reports of a military coup in the West African nation of Sierra Leone. A five-man military junta claimed to have taken control of the country and ousted the government of President Joseph Momo. Momo was reported to be safe at his home in Freetown, the country's capital. He was quoted as saying that some mutineers have been arrested, but gave no details. A leader of the rebel troops said that his men were not attempting a coup, but only trying to call attention to the fact that they haven't been paid for the past 7 months. After a week and a half of anti-abortion protests in Buffalo, New York, Operation Rescue announced an indefinite suspension of its activities today. More than 400 arrests were made during the protests. Ian Aronson of member station WBFO reports.
Anti-abortion activists say the Spring of Life protest is not over, but it's simply been put on hold. Spokeswoman Karen Swallow Pryor said the anti-abortion campaign will continue until Saturday as scheduled, and in the meantime, Operation Rescue leadership will reevaluate their strategy.
We've decided to withdraw during this indefinite period. There will be absolutely no demonstrations or activities on the street on the part of the pro-lifers. We'll spend this time just refocusing our energies and deciding what strategies will take place during the rest of the spring of life.
Abortion rights activists who all along called the protest ineffective note that area clinics have stayed open all week despite the protest and called the anti-abortion hiatus a victory. Abortion rights leaders still say, however, they'll maintain their presence outside area clinics until all Operation Rescue leaders have left Buffalo. For National Public Radio, I'm Ian Aronson in Buffalo.
Police in Newport News, Virginia, said that one person was killed and more than 50 hurt this morning when an Amtrak passenger train slammed into a dump truck at a rail crossing. Authorities said the train was headed north for Washington and New York with 92 passengers and 5 crew members. The driver of the truck was killed, but most injuries among the passengers were described as minor. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Shane Connaughton, co-wrote the screenplay for the movie My Left Foot, for which he was nominated for an Academy Award. Now he has a new movie, The Playboys. It's based on his memories of growing up in the 1950s in a small village in Ireland, just south of the border with Northern Ireland, where his father was the police sergeant. The movie stars Robin Wright as a strong-willed, independent, single woman who has a baby and, much to the dismay of the priest and everyone else in town, won't tell who the father is and won't give the baby up for adoption. Albert Finney is the village police sergeant who tries to force her into accepting his marriage proposition. Aidan Quinn plays a member of a touring theater group that livens up the village with its ragged performances. Connaughton also has a new novel about coming of age in a divided Ireland called The Run of the Country. He told me that his new film was inspired in part by his memories of what it was like when the touring theater troops performed in his village.
Well, it was very exciting because where I grew up, this village in Ireland, miles and miles and miles from anywhere, we weren't near Dublin, we weren't near Belfast, we were right along the border. Nothing ever happened there. The only thing that ever happened was when these actors used to come every summer for a week or two onto the village green. In the middle of this village there was a green, and they put a tent up, a marquee, and they perform plays there, melodramas and variety and a bit of Shakespeare. So of course it was the only thing exciting to happen all year, and certainly the only thing outside Mass exciting.
Was Mass exciting?
Well, no, I don't think it was, but it was. We had a priest there who was very dramatic in the pulpit, but he was trying to give us a bad time while the actors were trying to give us a good time. So he was trying to make us feel miserable. The actors were trying to make us feel good, and they certainly did. We loved them, and we thought, of course, the actresses were very exotic and erotic, and we looked on them like people today look on the Hollywood film stars.
In the very last scene of your movie, when the actors are leaving town, there's a kid who's just been in the background throughout the movie, but this kid is kind of chasing after the cars. Was that you?
Well, in a way it was, but actually the boy who played that part in the film, he's the son of a friend of mine I went to school with, so it was extraordinary to see my friend's children acting in the film, and certainly that boy, you know, in a way it was very strange because that boy is so like his father. Like when I went back there making the film, it was really like becoming a child again. It was an amazing experience because I'd look at these children and they were so like their father. So I don't think we die at all. We just come back in another generation.
There's a scene in the movie where the actors go in and they see Gone with the Wind, the movie Gone with the Wind, and they say, hey, we'll do that. And then the next night they're out there doing this really sloppy version of Gone with the Wind. Is that typical of what the theater troupe that came to your town did?
Well, there was one group who used to do things like, for instance, they did the whole Bible, the whole Old Testament. And the way can you imagine deciding on the spur of the moment to act out the Old Testament on stage, and the way they started it, a hand just reached out from the side holding an apple. So that was the kind of imaginative thing they could come up with.
Mm-hmm.
And so likewise doing Gone with the Wind. I mean, you see, because the cinema was a threat to their business, and because there was no cinema in the village, they'd go to the nearest big town, see the movie, and come back and act it out for the villagers, so the villagers wouldn't have to go and see the movie. The actors would act it out for them.
Right.
So in the Playboys, you get these actors acting out Gone with the Wind, and one of them playing Rhett Butler, etc., etc.
You shot the Playboys in your old hometown of Red Hills. Do you think the movie crew brought the kind of excitement to the town that you remember theater troupes bringing?
Oh, they did. It really was amazing because the village only has about 20 houses. And the surrounding population is only about 500. So when the movie crew came, they brought hundreds of people. It was so exciting. The villagers watched the shooting of the film every day. And when we did the night scenes, they stayed until 5 o'clock in the morning watching it. Because it was just like being a kid again with the actors.
Is the town still as repressive as it was? Because that's really a lot of what your movie is about.
Well, it's not anymore because, you see, in that age when the film was set, there wasn't television in Ireland. And, you see, the church had a very powerful hold on the people. People would argue for the better. But when television came, which is happening at the end of The Playboys, television came and went into everybody's room. And, you know, it had a huge impact on the life of the country. So it has changed completely because of television. You know, you could get American shows and Hollywood shows and shows from England and girls in bikinis. And, you know, so the priest could no longer control things.
Your movie The Playboys is in part about the town's two authority figures, the priest and the police sergeant, and their conflicts with the woman who's the town nonconformist. Now, in your town, your father was one of the authority figures. He was a police sergeant, yes?
That's right. He was quite a powerful man in the village because he was the police sergeant. He saw that the law was kept and not broken. And he was a very professional policeman because he had been a detective in Dublin in the early days of his life in the police force, but with a change of government, which happened in the 1930s, he was stopped from being a detective and put into uniform and sent up to this little place where there wasn't a lot of crime. So, you know, he spent all his days looking for crime, except there was no crime. So he was quite a frustrated man. As a policeman, he was quite a frustrated man. For instance, he was always dreaming of the perfect murder. So he was always hoping for a murder so he'd be able to crack it. But, of course, nobody murdered each other around there. I mean, the only crime was donkeys walking the roads unshod or hens trespassing into a neighbour's garden or something nonsensical. So he was quite a frustrated police person.
So how would he use his power if there wasn't a lot of crime for him to stop?
Well, he'd stop people going home from the pub at night time with no lights on their bicycles. Or he'd arrest people if they were drunk driving. But then when the IRA started a campaign, he was involved there.
Involved with trying to stop it?
Yeah, trying to stop it. But of course, because he was on the southern side of the border and they were active on the northern side of the border, they only passed through where we lived. So, but still, he would try and arrest them. But, you know, an ordinary policeman trying to arrest the IRA, he wasn't very successful. But then he was very ambiguous about the whole thing anyway because he was very anti the border. He was very anti the partition of Ireland. He was very anti-British. So he was in a strange quandary. He was a policeman looking for crime and it didn't exist. He didn't believe in the border, yet he was in search of the IRA, who didn't believe in the border. So there were all sorts of contradictions in his life, which made for a lot of frustration. But in other ways, of course, he was a fine man.
My guest is Shane Connaughton, and he wrote the screenplay for the new movie The Playboys, which stars Aidan Quinn, Albert Finney, and Robin Wright. He also co-wrote the screenplay for My Left Foot, and he has a new novel called The Run of the Country. Tell me more about what it meant to live in a border town.
Well, it's different to any other part of Ireland because most people, when they think of Ireland, they think of Connemara and Galway or down around the lakes of Killarney. But this part of Ireland, being on the border, it's got two religious communities. It's got one Catholic and one Protestant. It's got two political persuasions, one who believed that the border shouldn't be there and another who believed that it should be there. So it's got a mix that nowhere else in Ireland has. It's also a very, very beautiful part of Ireland. It's full of lakes and rivers and mountains. And it's the last outpost of Western Europe. It's completely undiscovered. But yet, as you can see from the film The Playboys, it's stunning territory. So the countryside was beautiful. I mean, I really had the run of the country. I could go anywhere in perfect safety, into the woods, the mountains, the rivers, the lakes. You know, we could go anywhere and play in safety all day long. It was wonderful for a child in one way. I mean, it's not like growing up in a city where parents are frightened that something's going to happen to their children. I mean, we had no sex perverts. We had no murderers. We, you know, there was nothing like that. We had complete and utter freedom. So that was wonderful. A wonderful childhood in that way.
Were you or anyone you know ever involved in arms smuggling like some of the characters you've created?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're growing up in a community, you know what's going on and you know everybody. And there was an IRA border campaign going on from 1956 to 1962. I was a teenager then. And so we knew people, yeah, and we all smuggled because, I mean, in those days, a pound of butter in our village was 5 shillings. But yet if you crossed over the border, you could get the same pound of butter for 2 and 6. So everybody went across the border to get their butter. It's called smuggling. People in the north came down for the and smuggled drink and cigarettes because it was cheaper in the south. So there was a whole thing still going on today. I mean, if you've got a border, no matter where it is in the world, you've got smuggling. The border between America and Mexico, the you know, borders everywhere. There's commerce. People live by it, make their living on it. Today, it's much cheaper to buy televisions, record players, videos in the north and than it is in the south. So lots of people go up from the south to buy these goods and smuggle them across. And then there were professional smugglers. We had a professional smuggler at home. People from all over Ireland would send orders to him and he'd do it. Sometimes he was caught, but he got away with it a lot. Incredible character.
Did your father approve of smuggling? Did he?
No, he didn't. He played it by the rules, everything. He was a very upright person. He never broke the rules at all. He was completely uncorruptible. He was like Robespierre. And politically, he was slightly to the right of Genghis Khan. But he never broke the rules. And he was against all rule breaking.
But you participated in smuggling. Did he ever find out about it?
No, he only once, when my mother, behind his back, sent me to get butter. And I rode over the border on my bicycle and brought it back, and I had the butter on the carrier at the back of my bicycle. And he was in the village when I came into the village, and he saw the butter on the back of the bicycle, and he knew that I'd smuggled it, and he was absolutely raging because you know the sergeant's son actually smuggling, it wasn't good. Plus, he was also raging that I didn't cover the thing up, put it into a bag or something. I mean, I had the butter there for everybody to see.
What were your understandings about the conflict in Ireland? How informed were you growing up?
Well, the conflict in Ireland, where I grew up, I was educated in a Catholic school, and we all knew that the border shouldn't have been there. We were taught that. The British partitioned the country and left us in a complete mess, which is still going on today. So it was, you know, we believed one thing, but other people believed something different.
So you wanted a united, independent Ireland?
Exactly. I still do. Because the Irish people have to learn to live in peace. You see, we haven't learned to live, as W.B. Yeats said, we haven't learned to live in peace with each other. That's why we're in conflict. We have to share the island in peace.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Shane Connaughton. He wrote the screenplay for the new movie The Playboys, which stars Aidan Quinn, Albert Finney, and Robin Wright. He also co-wrote the screenplay for My Left Foot, and he has a novel called The Run of the Country. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Shane Connaughton is my guest. He wrote the screenplay for the new movie, The Playboys, and he co-wrote the screenplay for My Left Foot. In your new movie, The Playboys, and in your new novel, The Run of the Country, there are both characters who are single women who have gotten pregnant. In the movie, that's just the scandal of the town, and it's you know, just the most sinful thing imaginable because she doesn't want to get married. She wants to bring up the child on her own, at least for now. Do you remember situations like this when you were coming of age, and was it just the worst thing?
Yeah, absolutely the worst thing, because you can imagine the sexual repression emanating primarily from the Catholic Church. I mean, sex was a taboo subject. You just didn't mention it. And for any girl, any single girl to get pregnant, it was just dynamite. She had no one to help her. She was usually ostracized, or things were made difficult for her. I mean, the child was called a bastard, and she was just looked down on as being an unfortunate kind of a woman. And quite a lot of girls, when they did get pregnant, rather than shame the family sent them to England, and they had the baby over there and put into orphanages. So it was a terrifying thing to happen.
There's a paragraph I'd like you to read from your new novel, The Run of the Country. The main character's best friend gets his girlfriend pregnant, and Prunty is his name, the best friend. And I'm going to have you read that paragraph.
Prunty knew what it meant, making a girl pregnant. The trauma, the stigma, born out of wedlock. A bastard. It sounded medieval. The outrage of family and community, the remarks passed, the hopeless, confined future. You were trapped for good and all. You could never get over it. Now was he a lucky boy. It was an unwritten law that if you took more than your fair share of pleasure, you eventually got more than your fair share of pain. He looked at the hedges, at the road flowing beneath his wheels, at the sky, his hands, trousers. They all looked unreal, stupid, hateful. He had planted something in Anna's belly, and it was going to grow and come out one day and sit looking at him, demanding to be fed. He was going to be what his father was, a father. He was going to be stuck dead center between the devil and the deep blue sea.
Did this happen to anyone you were close to?
Yeah, it did. It happened to quite a few people because, of course, no matter what the state of a repression is, nature will out. Nature has to take its course, especially with young people. So, yeah, there was always somebody in trouble. You always knew somebody, you know, and you were really hoping it wasn't going to happen to you.
So you must have grown up, pretty terrified in a way of the consequences of sex.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was no such thing as contraception in Ireland then. In fact, we've only just brought it in a few years ago.
There weren't even condoms?
No. Some brave souls went across the border and smuggled some back. But even Northern Ireland, that's a pretty repressed place too. It's not Catholic repression there. It's Puritan, Protestant repression. Same, but they're both the same, opposite sides of the same coin. So it was a predicament for young people. There was no such thing as sexual freedom, that's for certain.
One of the themes of your writing is leaving Ireland, or at least leaving the town that you grew up in. In one of your short stories, the mother who hasn't left says, "I wish I'd gone to America." Was there growing up always the sense that, well, you could have gone to America? Lots of other people in the family or in the town did.
Well, you see, my mother couldn't go. I mean, she had no money to go. And also, my mother had 8 children. I wasn't an only child. I write about an only child in the books because, in a sense, all children are only children, if you see what I mean. But my mother had 8. There were 8 of us in that barracks. So, you know, what could she do? She spent every minute of the day and night looking after us all. My father was the biggest child of the lot. I remember, in fact, my father was working in the garden one day. You know, he loved growing his own vegetables, and he was very good at it. And one of the younger children, the baby, was in the pram outside the barracks, and it started raining. And my mother came out and took the pram in out of the rain. And shortly, about 10 minutes later, my father came in, and he said to my mother, "You never came out and told me it was raining." And so he was like a child himself.
Yeah. How did you leave the town that you grew up in?
I left to go to England because there was no work in Ireland. And I had to go. When I finished school, there was nothing for me. In fact, I got one offer of a job in Dublin to learn the bar trade. And my wages was £1 a week and live in for 4 years or something. That's the only thing I got offered to me. I mean, it just wasn't for me. So I went to England, and like so many other people, I mean, the population was hemorrhaging out of Ireland in those days. Still is, in fact. So that's one of the curses of Ireland, that we have this terrible problem of no work for our young people. So I had to leave like everybody else.
But I suppose in leaving you were exposed to things you never would have been exposed to had you stayed. I mean, for instance, you became an actor. There wouldn't have been any opportunities if you'd stayed.
No, none whatever. That's the thing, you see. It's a double-edged weapon, I suppose. You don't want to leave home, but when you do, you've got tremendous freedom. You're suddenly on your own with no parents looking over your shoulder. You can do what you want, go where you want, do what you like, which is what I did, and I became an actor. My father didn't like me becoming an actor. He used to call it play-acting. When are you going to give up this play-acting, he used to say. But, you know, I did my own thing and made a life for myself, and that's what we all got to do, no matter where we come from.
Well, in America, you're best known for your writing. You've got your new movie, The Playboys, and you also co-wrote the screenplay for My Left Foot. How did you get to co-write that? What was the story behind that?
My Left Foot?
Yeah.
Well, the producer, Noel Pearson, who produced the film, asked me to write the script.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jim Sheridan, the director, he came on board and we co-wrote it. And then Jim begged them to let him direct it, because he'd never directed anything before, and eventually he persuaded them to let him direct it. But Jim and I had worked, I'd worked in the theatre in Dublin at one period after I came back from England, and he directed me in a theatre version of Down All the Days by Christy Brown, who wrote My Left Foot. And so we knew the subject matter well, and we knew each other well, and Jim was a director, theatre director in Dublin, and a very, very good one, a brilliant one with actors. So we knew our material, and Pearson asked us to do it, and we did it. And we never expected that it was going to be such a huge success. Nobody ever did. I mean, everybody told us we were mad. Writing a film about a cripple in a wheelchair, you're mad. Nobody would go and see it. But, of course, everybody did. In fact, it must have been one of the cheapest made movies ever. I think it only cost about £1 million, about $2 million. So when we came to America for the Oscars, we were told to pretend it cost about $6 or $7 million, otherwise people would think it was a home movie and not take it seriously.
Had you ever met Christy Brown?
Yeah, we did. When we did the theatre version of Down All the Days, he came to see us. And he was there in the audience, and afterwards at the party, you know, he could drink like a fish. He used to drink Guinness out of a pint glass through a straw. And you just see him sticking his mouth onto this straw and sucking, and the whole thing disappearing in a few seconds. I mean, he must have had a bladder like a ship's tank. He was an extraordinary character. He loved music, loved rock and roll, and he'd love you to catch hold of him, lift him up, and swing him around the room to a record. You know, he's an amazing man.
Did you do that?
Yeah, yeah, amazing fella.
Is your father still alive?
No, he died in 1983. So I don't know what he'd say about all this.
Right, you might not have written it had he been alive, maybe.
No, I started writing my first book aboard a station when he was actually in hospital dying of cancer. And I used to sit beside the bed writing in this notebook. And that's when it all started, because I could only write about it when he died, because it was like a huge weight being taken off my head. And I set out to understand him and to try and understand why I was afraid of him and why I loved him so much.
Well, Shane Connaughton, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Shane Connaughton wrote the screenplay for the new movie, The Playboys. His new novel, The Run of the Country, has just been published by St. Martin's Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, building a new ballpark with traditional values, open to the sky, natural grass, located in the heart of the city. We talk with Joe Spear, the principal architect of the Baltimore Orioles' new home. Also, rock historian Ed Ward warns us to look carefully at CD reissues before buying them. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the final episode of The Cosby Show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A jury in Simi Valley, California, has found four Los Angeles police officers not guilty in the beating of motorist Rodney King. On one count, a mistrial was declared, and this may lead to a new trial for one officer. The jury, however, acquitted the officers on 14 of the 15 charges against them. NPR's Wendy Kaufman takes a look at the change of venue, moving the case from Los Angeles to Simi Valley, and what effect this might have had on the trial.
I think the effect of moving the trial to Simi Valley will be something that will be debated very intently here. Simi Valley is a bedroom community of Los Angeles. It is a very white community. Only about 2% of the population is black, and there were no blacks on the jury. And to the African-American community, that was something that was very, very troubling to them from the very beginning, and it's something that I think, you know, they're going to be talking a lot about. Rodney King's civil lawyer said today that, you know, essentially this could not have happened in Los Angeles, but it did happen in Simi Valley, obviously the reference to not guilty verdicts.
NPR's Wendy Kaufman in Los Angeles. Rodney King's attorney says that he and his client are outraged that the verdict sends a bad message. An attorney for the man who videotaped the beating of King said that his client has a difficult time reconciling how his tape could have been so important when the four officers were found not guilty. In Afghanistan, the newly installed government is still fighting for control of the capital city of Kabul. Mark Tully in Kabul filed this report for the BBC.
Security is still the most serious problem. The Afghan Air Force has been on bombing raids. They appear to have been attacking positions to the south of the capital, where the anti-government forces of the Mujahideen leader Gulbuddin Hekmatyar are reported to have gathered. In one southern suburb, firing broke out when pro-government Mujahideen started searching for the anti-government guerrillas who had been driven off their position commanding the southern approach to Kabul. Residents of that suburb have complained that the pro-government Mujahideen have looted their home. They have also looted the Interior Ministry, which was captured from Hekmatyar's Mujahideen last night. Almost the entire city is without electricity, and there's an acute shortage of water. The police are nowhere to be seen, and the city is still in the control of different Mujahideen groups.
Mark Tully in Kabul. Officials in Bosnia have called for local forces to begin combat actions against the Federal Army. The Serbian-led Federal Army has refused orders from Bosnia to pull out of the state, and now state leaders are calling for a blockade of all army barracks. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 25 points to close at 3,333.18 on volume of some 213 million shares. This is NPR News. Democratic frontrunner Bill Clinton paid a visit to Capitol Hill today in the wake of a big primary victory in the state of Pennsylvania. Clinton met with House and Senate Democrats in efforts to unify his party behind his likely nomination. House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt predicted that wavering Democrats will now be announcing their support for Clinton, adding he thinks Pennsylvania may have broken the ice. Meanwhile, challenger Jerry Brown says he will continue his campaign, even though he concedes it's unlikely he can deny Clinton the nomination. The world's population has passed 5.4 billion, and it's expected to grow by 97 million a year until the turn of this century. That's one of the findings contained in a new UN report concerning global population. NPR's John Nielsen reports.
The report, called A World in Balance, concludes that basically it's out of balance. It affirms that most of the world's population growth is coming in the developing world, while most of the world's resources continue to be used by first world nations. It adds that 1.2 billion people are now living in poverty. Catherine Pierce, one of the authors, says the number of poor will continue to grow until the developed world steps up aid to poorer nations.
The task is to make development sustainable. We must begin now because every moment of delay makes success harder to achieve.
Defining and encouraging sustainable development is a main theme of the giant environmental summit meeting scheduled for Brazil this summer, but controlling global population growth is not. That's because a few countries, including the United States, will not agree that population growth is clearly linked to environmental damage. I'm John Nielsen in Washington.
The government says that personal income went up 0.6% last month for the second straight gain. The Commerce Department says that at the same time, spending was up by half that amount, by 0.3%. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Yardbirds were a band with a long and complex history, one which was never well served by the records they put out in this country. You'd think, then, that the recent Yardbirds reissue would be a vindication of this group's career. But rock historian Ed Ward says instead it almost serves as a textbook example of how not to do a reissue.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. The CD boom has been a real blessing for those of us who want to re-explore the musical past, and the willingness of labels to reach back into their vaults and present us with old treasures has been really gratifying. Of course, it's pure profit, since the sessions were paid for long ago, but still. There is a downside to all of this, though, and it was brought home to me the other night when I decided to check out a box set that's been sitting around my house for a couple of months, a four-disc collection of that all-important band, The Yardbirds. Now, the Yardbirds were a British invasion band that was completely captivated by blues, although some members of the band, and needless to say their management too, wanted to pursue a more pop-oriented direction. This cost them their first lead guitarist, Eric Slowhand Clapton, although it never bothered his replacement, Jeff Beck, or the band's other lead guitarist, Jimmy Page, who eventually created Led Zeppelin out of the Yardbirds' ruins. It's a fascinating story, one that I've enjoyed on a couple of bootleg records, because up until now, no legitimate attempt has been made to chronicle the Yardbirds. So a four-disc set from Sony, who own the tapes now, should be definitive. It's not. It's loaded with backing tracks like this one, and nearly all of a disastrous live album the band did with Chicago blues star Sonny Boy Williamson. There are two whole discs that are nothing but the band's blues recordings, often live recordings that don't show anybody off to best advantage. Even weirder, a number of tunes are included twice, albeit on different discs. Same song, same take, everything. And so much is missing. Not only the pop singles, which made the band famous, but also such guitar show-off pieces as Jeff's Boogie. If the point of this odd set is to show off the Yardbirds as a guitar-centered, blues-based band, it fails at that, too. How could this have happened? Beats me. The set was apparently compiled by Bruce Ader, a competent journalist and evidently a Yardbirds fanatic, and it could be the fanatic's tunnel vision that assumes that all of us are as interested in outtakes and incunabula as he is that makes this such a hash. At the very least, the folks at Sony Special Products should have drawn the line at some of the stuff on this project. But as it is, the Jeff Beck box set Epic released at the same time is a better overview of at least his time in the Yardbirds than these four discs are. Now, I'm not doing this just to trash a set that many of you may never see for sale. I'm warning you that, as time goes by, there'll be more stuff like this launched on an unsuspecting public. Best of sets that may be the best stuff an artist recorded for a given label, but which is hardly that artist's best stuff. And collections of outtakes and live recordings like this one that only a collector could enjoy. Sony Epic could help out by releasing a real Yardbird set sometime soon. Meanwhile, caveat emptor, y'all, and good luck.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. The Yardbirds reissue is on the Sony Special Products label. This is Fresh Air. Baseball fans, sports writers, and architecture critics are raving about the Baltimore Orioles' new home, Oriole Park at Camden Yards. It combines modern conveniences with traditional baseball values. It's brick, not concrete. There's real grass, no dome, and it's located in the heart of downtown. The ballpark is set against the old B&O Railroad warehouse, which is connected to it by a pedestrian walkway. My guest Joe Spear was the principal architect. His other projects have included New Comiskey Park, Wrigley Field renovations, and Buffalo's Pilot Field. He's now working on a new ballpark for the Cleveland Indians. His firm, Helmuth, Obata, and Kassebaum, specializes in sports facilities and is headquartered in Kansas City. Oriole Park at Camden Yards was built for baseball only in a move away from the multi-purpose stadium.
You know, you look back at the stadiums that were built in the late 60s and the 70s, and a lot of those buildings were driven by the fact that, you know, a city needed a football stadium as well as a baseball park. So someone suggested, just in the interest of economics, why don't, you know, you have multi-purpose facilities that do both. And really experiments or those efforts in the 70s are all really sort of coming up short, because, you know, the fans today see them as cold and impersonal, and they see the parks as a compromise. It's not really good for either baseball or football. And the teams, you know, that have to share those facilities, you know, invariably there's a dispute or disagreement about, you know, who gets to play Saturday night, who gets the prime dates, and who's the prime tenant.
Now, I know you wanted to capture the flavor of the older ballparks. On the other hand, I'm sure you put in some contemporary touches. What are some of the contemporary things that you incorporated in?
Oh, They have a club lounge level that's a separate, it's a second deck of the building, and the club lounge is the people that said that purchased those seats have access to an enclosed air-conditioned concourse, and they, you know, go back in there and if it's a slow game or a rain delay game, they can go back there and be comfortable in that lounge. It's sort of like a hotel lobby. And I think that's generated a lot of interest in the league.
What do you have to pay for a ticket with that?
I'm really not sure what they're charging for those on a yearly basis, but it's a rabid baseball fan would probably prefer a seat in the lower deck. So what we've really done is we've tried to enhance that sort of second tier of seating by creating an amenity package that goes along with that, and I think that they're quite happy with the way that seems to be working. other than that, it's got, you know, it's got the grass is on the field is natural grass and it's real, but it's got a very specialized turf system that is custom designed for Baltimore. And it has a series of irrigation pumps and drainage pumps so that they can do a number of different things with the playing field. I was talking to Pat Sandrone the other day, and he said that they did have a rain delay game, and they knew the forecast was for rain, you know, a rain shower that might last a half an hour or so. So what they did was they turned on the vacuum pumps and pumped the field very dry, so the ground beneath the grass was very dry. And then, as it rained, obviously the rain drained right through the field very quickly because the ground was dry. So they were able to get the game in that evening just because of that system.
So this is very high-tech natural grass.
It's very high-tech natural grass.
My guest is Joe Speer. He designs ballparks and stadiums, and he was the principal architect of the new Baltimore Orioles Camden Yards. The fans at baseball games are divided by class in many ways now. I mean, you've got these really well-appointed skyboxes in the new stadiums in which, corporations rent them for the season and then, take their best clients there. And these are, like, really beautiful, elaborate suites that overlook the field. I think fans often resent those skyboxes because sometimes they're built in such a way so that they hurt the view of other fans. In other words, because of where they're constructed.
Well, I know that I've heard that sentiment a lot. I don't agree that it makes the seats in the upper deck further away. I think really what the decisions that affect making the upper deck further away is the decision not to have columns in the lower deck seating. And that, I think, is the real reason that, you look at an old park and it's got, the upper deck that's right above the lower deck, and it seems so close. Well, it's not because we have suites. We added suites for the Cubs at Wrigley Field, and we didn't have to move that upper deck back. It's because you don't have columns in the seats, and a lot of people have sort of bemoaned the fact that there's no modern day park with columns in the seats. And so then people say, well, why couldn't you recreate that in a modern day park? And it just, to us seems to be, would be like saying, well, an old office building, a lot of times they were cold and drafty and the roofs leaked. Why, you wouldn't ever consider recreating those kinds of mistakes in an office building. So, why would you really want to build seats, a ballpark with 8,000 or 9,000 seats that were behind the columns and, less valuable, to the spectators.
Why is it that we're in a period when there seems to be a lot of new ballparks being built and older ones getting renovated?
I think it's, the industry has changed. I think that people, baseball fans used to be satisfied with just coming out to the ballpark and watching the game. Now they want to come out to the ballpark and enjoy the game and also enjoy the food and be able to park their car easily and get in and out and not feel like they're too crowded or sitting behind a post or all of those kinds of things. I think, the expectations of the customers are really driving, some of these kinds of decisions.
Is it revenue that's driving it too? The revenue that the team and the city gets from the ballpark?
Yeah, it is. Cities right now would very dearly love to attract a major league franchise, because it adds to the quality of life. You talk to the people in Buffalo that I worked for Pilot Field, and they feel that the park costs $32 million. They feel that that they got their money's worth just in the public image and the national image. When we first started before Pilot Field, the people in Buffalo felt that maybe Johnny Carson was right, about Buffalo being a sort of a cold and frozen wasteland, and now here you have this, you know, nice little baseball park and green grass in downtown Buffalo, and it really changed, you know, their self-image, and it changed their sort of their national image, I think. It really helped them feel good about themselves again. So I think that's part of it, too.
Are you a designer of ballparks and stadiums because you love the games?
Sure. I mean, we all have memories of the first game we went to with our folks, and people ask when we first got started in this as a specialty. They say, "Well, why would you want to design stadiums for a living?" And the answer is, it's a pretty powerful thing if you think about, you know, little kids going to the game, and you know, their childhood memories literally are framed by what you're doing. And at the time we got into it, though, there were a lot of my friends here in Kansas City sort of questioned the wisdom. You know, as an architect, don't you want to do, you know, real buildings? And my response was, well, gosh, these are buildings too. You know, they can be as great or as poor as your talent allows. And so, you know, that's sort of the attitude that we take into these projects. And it, you know, like I say, the outpouring and the acceptance of the park in Baltimore is sort of underscores that point. And you know, you work real hard for 3 or 4 years designing, getting one of these things built, and sort of that's the payoff. You know, you see your project on national TV, and people are very excited about it and very emotional and very in tune with what you tried to do. So you know, it's definitely worth it.
Joe Speer was the principal architect of Oriel Park at Camden Yards. He's a senior vice president with the firm Helmuth, Obata, and Kassebaum. When you hit the ball, knock it out of the park. Cause a singer will put you in the dark now. When you swing, swing, swing for the fence, Lord. Hitting in a double play. Sam and Dave on Fresh Air. Let's see what they have for us at All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We have a talk today with Lynn Yackel, who was the victor in the Democratic Senate primary in Pennsylvania yesterday. She ran a campaign that was heavily based on a commercial showing Senator Arlen Specter, the Republican incumbent, questioning Anita Hill at the Senate Judiciary Committee last year. And that seemed to have moved, seems to have moved a great many voters. Also, we'll be hearing today from Douglas France of the Los Angeles Times, an investigative reporter, about a meeting in late May of 1990, just 2 months before Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, at which American officials decided to in no way change U.S. policy, which was very friendly, toward Baghdad.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Cosby Show ends its 8-year reign tomorrow night with a 1-hour special episode. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
The best TV series usually find a way of coming up with the best endings. MASH ended with the end of the Korean War. The Mary Tyler Moore Show ended with the lights going out in the WJM newsroom. And St. Elsewhere ended with the whole series explained away as an ongoing fantasy of a daydreaming autistic kid. Well, The Cosby Show closes with some equally nice touches. I won't spoil the surprises, but I will say the finale is built around Theo's college graduation ceremony. And that's really special, because it completes a storyline and repeats a pro-education moral that Bill Cosby has been hammering home ever since the series premiered in 1984. You have to think back to the mid-80s to remember the kind of TV climate The Cosby Show was stepping into. It was a time when the sitcom had just about been pronounced dead, and the only nuclear family sitcom in the top 20, The Jeffersons, was a very different kind of family and series than the one Cosby would bring to NBC. In fact, there was a moment in the very first Cosby Show that you can point to and identify as the point where Bill Cosby changed the course of TV history. If you saw the scene, I'll bet you still remember it. It's the one where Theo Huxtable, played by 13-year-old Malcolm Jamal Warner, defends a bad report card by appealing to his dad's loving nature.
You're a doctor and Mom's a lawyer, and you're both successful in everything, and that's great. Maybe. I was born to be a regular person and have a regular life. If you weren't a doctor, I wouldn't love you less because you're my dad. And so, instead of acting disappointed because I'm not like you, maybe you can just accept who I am and love me anyway because I'm your son.
Theo, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. No wonder you get D's and everything.
The studio applause after Theo's speech was an almost ingrained reaction to the kind of kid-knows-best comedies of the 70s and early 80s. When Bill Cosby's Cliff Huxtable rejected Theo's argument as being stupid, he was also rejecting all those formula comedies and blazing his own trail to the top. It was a brilliant move, and lots of other sitcoms followed suit. Theo's character, however, was far from brilliant. As the years went by on the show, he kept struggling with grades, until many years into The Cosby Show, Theo was diagnosed as having dyslexia. His parents got him help to deal with his reading disability, and that turned Theo's attitude and life around. So the finale, with Theo getting his college degree, is a perfect way to end the series 8 years later. On Dateline NBC this week, Cosby told Jane Pauley he thought The Cosby Show had gone on 1 year too long. I'd agree, but that doesn't minimize what the show accomplished. As comedy, it provided some classic bits, like the lip-syncing concerts in the Huxtable living room. As a provider of positive role models, it was virtually unsurpassed in primetime, not just for black families, but for all families. And that's what's so infuriating about all the talk about The Cosby Show not being realistic or representative or not black enough. Nobody ever accused Danny Thomas in Make Room for Daddy of not being representative of most Lebanese people. And did anyone ever complain about designing women, that most white women don't live that way? Of course not. But Bill Cosby, who paved the way for blacks on TV in the 60s by starring opposite Robert Culp in I Spy, is still hearing the same junk 3 decades later. The settings and concerns of The Cosby Show are true to his experience, and that's all they have to be. So give Cosby some credit. Not only did he come up with the most popular TV series of the 80s and the most socially responsible, but with one of the funniest. It wasn't a black show, it was a human show. Theo learned his lesson after 8 years of The Cosby Show, so why can't some of Cosby's critics learn theirs and acknowledge what he did do rather than complain about what he didn't?
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Richard Parker, and Thad Kirk. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how political polls reflect and manipulate public opinion. We talk with David Moore, a pollster who's written a new history of the subject. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.